Before rock and roll, before pop, before everything, there was the blues, the music of struggle, triumph, and truth. Welcome to Talking Blues, where we honor the legends and tell the stories that shape modern music. Here's your host, Matt Cooper.
We pick things up with Jerry Mercer aboard the legendary Festival Express. It was a cross-Canada rock and roll train ride from 1970, featured some of the biggest names in music at that time. Despite the chaos and financial setbacks, the organizers really kept the wheels turning, took good care of the artists. Jerry was there.
Just, you know, I mean, who else would do that? You know, it's just one of those experiences. And it was so great for everybody that everybody was ready to do it for free just so those people could. We were so grateful for how they treated us, just so they could make their money back. That was the attitude.
Well,
then we got back. It was supposed to be a film like Woodstock. And then it got into arguments about who owned what and the rights to this and the rights to that. And so the whole thing got shelved and put away for legal wrangling purposes. And nothing happened until the son of one of the cameramen on that tour discovered his father had a whole load of footage. And so he was the one that trotted that out and put together the film of the Festival Express. And that's why it took so many years before it came out 2000 and something. So it's like almost 30 years after the event. Yeah. But it's why it took so long. Yeah, because of the legal wrangling.
But a very nice touch to that point, and maybe it's, you know, kind of died with the era, but the law of reciprocity, you know, the promoters, even though they ended up taking a bath, if you pardon the geographical expression, yep, on the show, they still treated the performers like gold. And the turnaround was, yes, the performer said, hey, guys, you know what? Even though we do this all the time, we'll come back for free because you treated us like gold and we want you to make your money back. And that is a beautiful concept itself.
Yeah. Well, this was to a person.
Yeah.
To a person. I never heard of anybody who opposed that idea, not crew or stage. So it was nice to have that sense of unity. Everybody just appreciated so much. We were all in the same train. Yeah, we were all on the same page. It was great.
So when Festival Express wound its way through, take me from the time there to Mosh McCann's next album. And then after that, you kind of said, you know what? I'm going to take a break from this because rock and roll bands, sometimes they break up, shocker, and move on. And then April Wine was on the horizon. So let's go there.
Well, that's what basically happened. We did an album. We did a second album. And no hits came off of it. And then we did an extended play with four songs produced by the same guy that produced the Guess Who. And nothing came of that. So the record company says bye-bye. I mean, that's the way it goes. You had two shots. You had your success with the first one, but you had two shots to have a follow-up and nothing happened. So bye-bye. That's the name of the game. That's just the way the business is. So Mosh McCann continued with Pierre and some other musicians. Ray Blake and Brian hooked up with a girl and they formed a trio and they did their thing. And I was basically at home waiting for the phone to ring and it wasn't ringing. Wow. Had an interesting few months. I read the Bible from front to back. I studied some philosophy. I'd listened to some interesting philosophers on the FM radio in Montreal. Was really sophisticated at the time.
So Mosh McCann had a rockin' single, a rockin' first album. Second one didn't go so well. They carried on. You took a couple months off, read the Bible. I don't know how many people can say that.
I got to tell you another story, yeah, because it's a case of how one thing after another happens that you didn't plan, and yet it's like doors open where you didn't even know there was a door. During this period, I went to a club that we used to play at a lot, and we were very popular in that club. So I went there to see who was playing that night. And someone said, yeah, your guitar playing friend, J.P. Lozon, he's over in Andre Perry's new studio playing with some guys from California. Why don't you drop over and say, I thought, wow, I haven't seen J.P. in quite a few months. I would go over to the studio and say hello. So I go over to the studio and yeah, sure enough, J.P.'s there with three guys out of a four-piece group from California, two guitar players and a bass player. And so I walk in and J.P. introduces me to Bob Sagarini, member of the head of the group. And Bob says, you're a drummer. I said, yeah. He says, sit here. Yeah, that was it. So within minutes, I just introduced to the group and I'm sitting down and we're jamming. And we're jamming all kinds of stuff. The three guys in the band knew what they were doing. But JP was at the other end of the big room with his guitar stack. I was at the other end in front of the glass control room with the drums. And the other three guys were in the vocal booth together. So I couldn't see them. So I can only hear. And they're doing medleys, rolling from one tune to the next and shit like that. I have no idea what's coming next. It's total jam. Anyway, we have great time for a couple hours. That tape ends up going back to New York with their producer. He's in the studio listening to playback. In comes another producer named Peter Siegel, who, for some reason, hones in on who's playing drums on this jam. So the guy gives him my name. Next thing I know, I get invited to go to New York to play tracks for... Oh my God, I'm going to forget her name. A solo lady, really, really good, powerful singer, acoustic guitar player. Anyway, he was producing her. So I went to New York, nervous as a cat, because I know you can swing a cat in New York and hit 100 great drummers. What the hell is the guy from Verdun going to New York to record for, right? Anyway, I got in there with a good attitude, nervous or not, played my parts. It all went well. Our working arrangement was great. This turns out to be the same guy who produces Roy Buchanan. Roy being a phenomenal guitarist, standalone guitarist, okay? Kind of like Jeff Beck or on that level. And I end up playing, I recorded Roy's second album with him and then ended up joining the group that formed up to go and do a three-month tour. We went all over Europe and England. We went to the Montreux Jazz Festival. All of that took place, yeah, after the MASH McCann scene and before April Wine. I was down in the States having the group disbanded in Europe, so I came back to Washington, which was where my drum kit was left when we left to go to Europe, and I pick up my stuff and I hook up with some musicians that I'd met, and we end up forming a local group, and I'm jamming with them in some of these local scuzzy clubs around Chesapeake Bay. And almost every night, you know, you get on stage and you grab a mic stand and you stand there and try to prevent someone from jumping on stage and using your instrument as a tool to beat somebody else with. The fights were, I mean, they're violent down there. So you just basically grab a mic stand and use it to protect your instruments on stage. Anyway, I did that for a couple of months and was very happy to get a call from Miles and Jimmy saying April Wine was revising and the Henman brothers were leaving and we'd like you and Gary Moffat to come in. If for me, it was like, well, April Wine is not my favorite group, not my favorite music, but about a year earlier, I had Jimmy and Miles and Gary Moffat over to my house just to jam, have an evening, like, yeah. And it was great. I couldn't tell you one thing we played, but I remember the chemistry. So when they called me up and asked me to join the group, it was the memory of the chemistry that made me say, yes, something here can work. Not the fact that they'd already had a hit or I liked the songs, none of that. It was the chemistry that I remembered from that jam night. So I said yes, and then, you know, everything else followed. It's interesting. When I joined the group, they were halfway through their third album. The group had recorded five songs. So we came in and recorded four songs, and then we recorded an addendum to one of the songs they had already done. Just like on the end of Layla, Derek and the Dominoes version comes to the end of Layla, and there's a pause, and then you hear that nice piano that comes in. Da 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 da. And it all swells and it's great. So we were trying to add an addendum to Electric Jewels, which is the title track of the album, Electric Jewels, In the Hands of Fools. That was referring to management. and so we did. So the third album is 4.5 songs each. 4.5 by the old group, 4.5 by the new group. And then we did Stand Back. And that really took off because there wasn't a bad track on Stand. The production was not great. We, you know, not experienced at producing, but the tracks were great and the album was popular and it opened up everything for us. Yeah, that was great.
What were those?
So we hit the road and we thought, hey, we're on our way. But after a year of slugging it out, we found ourselves all living together in one house on the south shore of Montreal, a farmhouse, drawing $75 a week each. So when I say we restarted from scratch, we restarted from scratch and grew from there. That was great.
You know, because this is now 73, 74, you're in the Quebec farmhouse. You guys are getting ready to rock large. Tell me about some of the names that you were mingling with, because you would have been doing a lot of 70s touring, and there was a lot of high-profile bands there that you would have been interacting with. Can we share a few memories that stood out backstage, on the road, 70s funny stuff?
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, I can't remember everybody we opened for, because at 86... names are the hardest thing for me to remember. I remember songs, can't remember names. But the most memorable, of course, was playing at the Elmo Combo with the Rolling Stones. We were also supposed to do a South American tour after that with the Stones. Their people and our people were discussing, but somehow it never came to fruition. That was nice. We did two gigs with them. The thing that was neat was we did the smallest gig that they had done in a decade. They'd not played in a club. They had not played in a club since the early 60s, pretty much. And so to do a gig in a club, a live gig in a club, was a new thing for them. And then the second gig we did was Rich Stadium in Buffalo, 80,000 people. From the stage, you looked out and it was a sea. Completely in the top ranks of the sea, it was full. And we were on the bill with the Atlanta Rhythm Section, mm-hmm. and I think Three Dog Night, and there's the Stones. So it was a nice bill, and it was totally the other end of the scale, from the smallest gig working in a club to this kind of a thing. And when you work that kind of a gig with the Stones, they hire magicians who come backstage and entertain you while you're waiting to go on stage. They bring in entertainers for the entertainment, you know. They brought in, they had a magician and a couple other people backstage just to keep things interesting for the, you know, the musicians and their entourages who were waiting in the wings. And I thought it was kind of a nice touch. I'd never experienced that before. But then again, we'd never played on a opening for a band on that level before. So, yeah, it was kind of nice.
Right. And the gig just before that, you mentioned at the Elmo Combo. And that was a big throwback for the Stones, because they hadn't
done clubs in 15 years. That happened because we had somebody in our camp who knew somebody in the Rolling Stones camp. And that's how it got put together, that we ended up working the club in Toronto with them. And I had a story involved in that, and it's gone out of my head.
I believe the record was...
It's important, it'll come back.
I believe the record was Love You Live that the Stones did. And that was right around the time Keith had his rescue from the Blind Angel, if I recall.
Well, that was the trip on which we missed the first night of recording because they got busted at the airport. Keith got busted at the airport. We were supposed to play that first night, and we ended up playing on our own. And it was the next night that that the Stones came in, the next two nights. But the first night, nobody knew what was going on, right? I mean, the people who won the contest, there were contest winners who were picked up at the radio station in a bus, carefully loaded, and the bus drove to the club and unloaded carefully around the back door so that people couldn't see what was going on. But the next day after the Stones had appeared, of course, it was an explosion in all the newspapers and everywhere. So the next night we had to have escorts to even get close to the club. The streets were like mobbed, you know. Thousands of people wanted to get into a 350-seat club. Anyway, it was an amazing experience to play with them. Charlie Watts was the guy I probably spoke with the most. And Charlie was Charlie. He was very straight, low-key, you know, you get what you see kind of guy. He loved jazz, and he spent time at home doing things he loved to do. He played rock and roll for a living. Seems that I'm going down a similar path in jazz, but just not on drums.
Yeah, strong roots, strong jazz roots for Charlie in the beginning.
Good jazz drummer, you understand?
Huh? I was going to say strong jazz roots for Charlie, Charlie Watts, before the Stones.
Of course. Like me, it's something he got turned on to at an early age and was interested in. But at the same time, you realize that it was hard to make a living playing jazz. And it was more fun being a rock and roll musician. So that steered a lot of us away from the commitment to jazz, even though it was a first love.
Just while we're talking jazz, we were talking on the phone the other day, and you were telling me about a time in, I guess it was in Montreal, where you saw Miles Davis in a club. Can you take us back to that night?
Yes, it's a club called the Black Bottom in Montreal. Not a big place. Regular, you know, a stage that was probably a foot and a half off the ground level. But Tony Williams on drums and Miles and Wayne Shorter. I mean, to see these people play live was mesmerizing, because they were so relaxed and so competent at what they did. And the style and sound, Miles was fresh as a daisy in those days, because Miles was always trying to be fresh as a daisy. He was the one guy who constantly changed. He went from bebop to jazz to fusion. And later in life, he was trying all kinds of experiments with all kinds of different musicians. He never stopped experimenting. He didn't get to a point where this is successful, I'll continue doing this. That just wasn't Miles.
Yeah, we were also talking about how Montreal was a significant stop for Black musicians traveling through the U.S., especially from Chicago, a very vibrant nightlife, the Chitlin' Circuit.
Yeah.
I mean, the Chitlin' Circuit.
The Chitlin' Circuit arrived in Montreal by way of the Esquire Show Bar on Stanley Street. Not a big place, probably 200 people, pretty full, 200, 210, pretty full. But that was the mecca for R&B. All of the guys that were on the Chitlin' Circuit coming up from the States, they'd play New York and they'd come up to Montreal. And the Esquire Show Bar featured two bands at the same time every night. And it was seven nights a week from 9 to 3. Two bands. One band would start at 9 o'clock, and around 20 minutes to 10, they'd start intermission riff, and the other musicians would one by one slip into place and replace the musicians who were already on stage. I think the drummer would slide in and, you know, pick up a stick and away they go. Piano player would slide in the bench, the other piano player would slide in. We did that. And then that band would play for 40 minutes, and then they'd go into intermission riffs, and the other band would change the musicians one after another. The music was continuous. The talent was amazing. The level of talent. I consider the Esquire Show Bar to be my alma mater, where I really learned to play drums, because I could go and sit and watch. I'm sitting at the bar. The drummer is sitting 3 feet away from me, and my nose is just a little bit above his bass drum pedal. So from that perspective, you can see his hands, his fingers. You can see every part of his body and what he's doing. I studied drummers in there. I didn't take lessons, but I studied drummers. I mean, 7 nights a week, I'd find myself in there, sometimes 6 out of the 7. And I was working at IBM at the time. I was getting up and going to work in the morning. I'd come home at night, grab an hour of sleep, and then head to the club till 3 in the morning. If they were a hot band, I was there. There was just no staying away.
The Chitlin' Circuit, for our listeners that might be too young to know, the Chitlin' Circuit was an informal network of venues across the United States and Canada that provided a safe performance space for African-American entertainers during the era of racial segregation,
yes.
Roughly from the 30s to the 60s. Yeah. I think Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, James Brown. Here's a fun fact for you, Jerry. You probably know the term Chitlin' Circuit derives from chitterlings, a soul food dish made from pig intestines, symbolizing
chitlins.
Making the best out of limited resources. That doesn't say at all right there.
Yes. Yeah. That was a magic time. I think it was rough for those musicians. They had to travel a lot and work a lot. I don't know how much they got paid. I have no idea. But those guys worked hard. And when you're playing 7 nights in a week and you're doing four sets a night, 7 nights, that's exhausting. That's exhausting. And then they'd leave Montreal and they'd go somewhere else. And I don't know whether every place they went was 7 nights a week, but the Esquire Show Bar was 7 nights. You come in on a Monday, you left the following Sunday.
Well, coming up from Mississippi to Montreal, that'd be about 14, 15-hour drive. And I guess they would
That would be long. But I would imagine most of them would come to Montreal from a place like New York or Boston. You know what I mean? Right. So they weren't driving up from the South per se. But the circuit was all over the United States.
Yeah.
Every city had a club that was playing R&B. It was all over the place.
Toronto.
It's just that up here in Canada, the only one in Montreal was the Esquire Show Bar. And in Toronto, I think it was the Brass Rail.
Well, we had the Colonial Tavern in the 50s and the Club Blue Note on Yonge Street.
Colonial Tavern, that's right. It is an element that young musicians today do not have. Now, they've got all kinds of videos. They can have videos of the best players in the world come in and teach them in the sense of the techniques. But I had the pleasure of being able to go out into a small club and see these giants play. I saw Oscar Peterson and his trio a few times in clubs. All kinds of great musicians when the clubs were the things. They hadn't opened up the big venues yet. So in the 60s, it was magical to see these giants in these small rooms. And you're sitting like, hey, Joe Pass, one of the most amazing guitar players I'd ever seen. He was playing in a little place called the Rising Sun. Probably 100 people would fill the club. And Joe Pass would put a chair on the middle of this little stage and he'd come out and sit down in his chair. He never spoke. He never introduced. He never did anything. He picked up his guitar and proceeded to absolutely blow my mind. The man could play any number of songs and he knew all of the melodies and could play you a melody, giving you a chord underneath each note of the melody. That would be not the same as, but related to the progression of chords that were going to take you to the next change. I mean, it was magical. And I'm sitting like 8 feet away at a table with my jaw dropping, just listening to the magic coming off of this man's acoustic guitar. Didn't even need a sound system. How many young players can go out and find that kind of a thing happening in their neighborhood? That doesn't happen anymore, you know? To see that kind of greatness at your fingertips. Well, now it's at the fingertips because a couple of clicks and it's on your screen. But it's not the same thing as going in and experience the feeling, the feeling you get from watching these people play, listening to the inspiration, and just, yeah, it's a magical quality. I just feel so blessed that I've seen so many people live that I can remember. I wish I had videos of them, but in those days, we were more interested in listening to the music than in taking pictures. Today, the last time I went to a concert was to see Mark, oh my God, big Latin guy. Anyway, I was excited to see him. I enjoyed his music. I enjoyed his records. I enjoyed his arranging, everything. So I go to the CNE, and he comes out on stage, and the place is full of, all the front is full of Latinas. They all leap out of their chair. Nobody is sitting down. And everybody's got their arms up in the air with their telephones in their hands. So when you looked at the stage, you saw a sea of arms with phones up on top of them. Everybody was filming. Filming and dancing. I mean, it's just bizarre. I found that you couldn't just sit down and enjoy the concert. You couldn't even see it properly because so many things were in front of you. I thought that kind of spoiled it. It was nicer when people just went and enjoyed the music and danced and took in the here and now experience, whereas everybody's more concerned about getting the later on experience by being able to show their friends what they got on their phone.
You know, there was a real nugget of wisdom in there that I don't want to let fall to the wayside in terms of the grueling schedule.
That was a big factor, which I wasn't even aware of in those days. You know, I was so naive that in the 50s, I didn't realize that the black musicians I was going to see in 60 and 61, they couldn't vote. They couldn't even vote in their own. I had no really sense of the cultural issues that were going on at the time. The few black people I had met and dealt with were fine. They were just, to me, other guys. So their skin was different. But apart from that, you know, I played football with them or, you know, played music or sang in the choir. They're just folks to me.
Well, in Canada, race wasn't really an issue. I mean, we're a mosaic. We're a melting pot. Or not a melting pot, a mosaic.
Yeah.
You know, a mosaic. And so I grew up with all sorts of different nationalities. And like you said, it was just guys and girls. No big deal. But it's a little different for our neighbors to the States. They grew up with different attitudes. But for us in Canada, it's a bit of a shock. I didn't know that the African-American struggles that took place until I was much older.
Yeah, that's it. I just wasn't aware. I was so, you get wrapped up at that age at 20, 21, 22, 23. You're wrapped up in your own fun and your own career and what's going on. And it was just sleeping, you know. Just being asleep at the wheel, not really seeing what was going on around me, enjoying the music and not realizing what the creators of that music had to go through, where that music truly, where the roots came from. I didn't have a concept or understanding. That came later.
And the proficiency of those musicians came from those grueling sets 7 nights a week, that woodshed concept on the stage. And I think the young musicians are missing that today. And I want you to tell them how important that is.
Well, all of the musicians basically will tell you the same thing. Regardless of how good they are today and how fast they could play today, they had to start counting 1, 2, 3, 4 at a tempo that they could play at. So if you have a tune that dunk, 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 and it's up there swinging, that's not where they started to play. It was 1, 2, 3, 4. And somewhere down there, they were walking slowly through their parts. And you build up to that kind of speed and confidence. Everybody starts by crawling. So you learn to slow things down and play them right and pick up the speed. The ones who don't do that end up playing fast, but not clean. They almost get their parts. You know what I mean? It's sloppy. They manage to execute it, but it's not, it's, yeah, it's just not clean. I find that if I'm going faster than I'm capable of going, I'm scuffling on the instrument, whether it's drums or bass. And scuffling is a very uncomfortable feeling when you're a performer. You don't want to be scuffling on your instrument or whatever you're doing. You want to be comfortable.
I think that concept is a really a universal truth, because if you look at anything...
Yes, you really have to start slow, be patient with yourself. If you can't get it right away, slow it down some more. There's a speed at which you can do the thing. You just have to be patient enough to slow it down and find that speed at which you can do that thing. And then once you've found it, pay attention to doing it right, and the speed will build.
That's how our brains are hardwired.
That's what I find. Yeah. I mean, there's a little licking chameleon. That lick that happens at the end before the drum pass brings it all back in again. That pass, da 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 da. I must have played that on the bass 1,000 times, because all I could go is da 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 ba da ba da da da. Very slow, one note at a time. Well, the band, you can't perform the song at that speed and make anything happen. So I'd sat and played it and played it and played it and played it until I could do it at a speed that was now approaching performance. And then I practiced some more until I could play it faster than I needed to play it, so that when I was playing it at the proper speed, I felt comfortable. I knew I could play it much faster.
You created the muscle memory.
So that was my memory. Yeah, take it over the top a little bit when you're home practicing. And if you can play it faster, clean, then when you slow it down to the tempo you're going to play it with the band, you know it'll be right.
That also gives you a chance to bring in another element. So, I mean, if you don't have to think about your bass playing, you can now sing.
That's the newest thing. It's funny, I started as a singer, but all those years playing with April Wine, I really did just backgrounds and oohs and ahs, and, you know, in the recording studio I might sing. But, I mean, I wasn't singing every night in the true sense of singing. And I'm now trying to get that together again. I want to be able to sing at least a half a dozen of April Wine's more popular soft tunes, not in Miles' style, but in my own. And I'll learn them and find the key that works for me, and be able to play them on my bass with a hi-hat playing the 2/4 backbeat. And that's it. That's as naked as I want to be able to make it, and I want it to work. So I'm starting there. I got a half a dozen tunes that I'm working on, and when I'm satisfied with my own arrangement and my own performance, then I'll bring in our guitar player, and he'll learn what I've learned and play it with me. And then if the rest of the band is interested, they can add their parts, the flute player and the percussionist. But I'm prepared to just learn to do it alone. I figure if I'm satisfied with what I'm doing by myself, anything that I add is just icing on the cake. But I've got to be the cake.
And the ingredients have to be solid for the cake to have even entertain having any icing on it.
That's why I try, you know, to learn the bass parts, keep them simple. The trickiest thing is pitching when you're playing bass only. You can be a quarter tone off and not realize it. So pitching yourself with a bass is a little tricky when there's no other instruments happening. Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. Maybe it's only tricky because my ears have been pounded out. I have to wear hearing aids, which changes the sound of things. But something happened with my hearing that's weird. I'll mention it to you. But for years, I thought I had pretty much perfect relative pitch. And one time I was getting my piano tuned, and the guy finished doing it, and I was sitting down playing chromatically up the notes to make sure everything sounded right to me. And when I got the middle C, I worked up to the next octave. That was fine. But just as I was approaching the C in the third octave up from the middle C, when I got to the B flat and went to the B, they're only half a tone apart. But in my ears, it sounded like about a 2.5 tone jump. It was like going from B flat to to D or something. I could never explain it, but I said to the guy, "You're not. This is not tuned properly." He said, "Yeah, sure it is." I said, "No, listen to that." And I ran up chromatically and I'd go between my two notes and I said, "Don't you hear how that jump is? It's totally out of tune." He says, "No, it's not." And he put the meter on it. It was perfect. It was perfectly in tune. Something happened to my ears so that once it goes above that particular sound, my pitch goes for a crap. So when I'm listening to a piano player who goes up in the top end of the piano, it sounds like he's playing in a different key to the chords of the song. Or if the flute goes up into that neighborhood, it's the same thing. Suddenly it sounds like he's playing in a different key, not relative to the background that I'm listening to. Very weird. So I had to learn to accept that, and I can't change it. I can only recognize it and learn to work with it. But it's become a strange hearing phenomena for me.
I have something similar. I've been a music fan all my life. I'm pushing 60 now, and there's some parts of songs I just can't hear anymore. You know, I'm expecting...
What is that?
I'm expecting to hear a guitar come in or something, and it's just not there. And I'm thinking, is there something wrong with the stereo? Is it my speakers? And my dear doctor said, "No, it's you, son." So I've got a pair of, you know, funky old man hearing aids, but
I've got them on both ears.
Yeah,
You can see them. I've got them on both ears, and I've got them turned up.
I don't know, Jerry. There's something. I don't know what it's called.
I need it
but there's parts of songs I just never hear again, and you just got to live with it.
Yeah, those little hairs in the cochlea, they're laying down. They ain't getting up. That's what it is. They're a whole series of hairs. And when they get blasted too hard, all of them lie down. You know, the first time I walk into the a sound check in the afternoon, the first time I hit my snare drum, it sounds loud. But after a minute or two, it doesn't sound loud anymore. Why is that? It's because the ears close up to protect themselves. And so all those hairs, when they get bombarded by something that's super heavy, they lay down. And then at the end of the gig, as the night is over, your hearing slowly comes back as the hairs begin to stand up again. Problem is they don't all get up. Some of them have been, you know, they're down for the count. So little by little, you have fewer guys getting back up. And that's when you end up with a hole in your hearing. Like mine occurs around 36 to 4,000 hertz. In that bracket, that's where my hearing hole is. Things that go on in there I need to, if I'm getting something EQ'd, I need to amplify those frequencies in order to make it make sense to my hearing.
Well, I don't know the frequency of my hole. As a matter of fact, the last time I saw you in person was probably 93. It was the Attitude Tour, and you were making your way through Timmins.
That was the first time, we had been apart for a long time, up until 92. So Attitude was the first album we did when we came out of retirement. And it was one of my favorite albums. There's a few compositions on it that I really like. But apart from that, it was a totally different recording experience than what I had gone through before with the group. I had hard times with Miles and Mike Stone when Miles and Mike were co-producing. It's like they would get together and make my life hard. Well, by the time I came to the Attitude album, I had 8 years away from the group, and I, you know, studied and learned and grown somewhat. So when we got together to do Attitude, I was not going to sit and wait for someone else to tell me whether that was good enough. I conducted my own session. We did the basic track. I told them when I was coming in to listen. I told them when I wanted to do another one. I told them when it was good enough. I made all the decisions. And so that album, when I listen to the tracks, it feels good to me. all the drum tracks on there were solid. And, you know, and it's because I was in command finally of my own stuff and not being brought down by someone else's needless criticisms. A guy named Nick Lagona, he was an engineer and producer. And you could be in the studio for 12, 13, 14, 15 hours, an exhausting day. And you're out there trying to do something. And Nick was the kind of guy who was in the control room on the microphone, giving you positive feedback. Every time you do a take, he would say, "That's really great. You're having a little problem on the pass entering into the first chorus. The next time we do it, just before you do that pass, just take a breath. Just, you know, be aware of that, not rushing." He would say things like that. And sure enough, the next time you do a take, you'd go through that part, it would be perfect. The man knew how to give you constructive criticism, which helped you perform better. No matter how long, what time of the day, how many hours you'd been at it, Nick could always help you get better. And I thought that was, to me, he was one of the best producers I ever worked with for that reason. He knew how to draw the best performance out of every musician. That's a gift.
Do you remember your tour manager for Attitude?
We had a new crew for Attitude because it was a restartup. So we had a few Ottawa guys, as a matter of fact. But like Ken Schultz and those guys who had stayed with us and been a part of our crew for many years, this was a whole new startup with Attitude. And it took a few years being back together and crew members changing until we again settled on a three-man crew that was comfortable and consistent. You got with crew member. I mean, we had one guy who was a good guitar player and singer, a good rocker, but he was having more fun hanging out with the band than actually being on stage doing the hard work of taking care of the equipment. He was being more of a musician than a roadie, if you know what I mean.
I do.
So you got to have people who regard their job as roadieing just as professionally as you regard your job as a musician.
Everybody's got to do their part. Well, I remember your tour manager on the Attitude Tour because when you rolled into my radio station in Timmins in 93, you guys came up the stairs, blew into my control room. Your tour manager came over, put his arm around me, and said to me, "No, you're in control, my man. You're in control of the situation. Just relax." I'm like, "Oh, okay."
Did he have a French accent?
I don't remember, but he was very comforting.
Okay,
because I was
we did have a guy who was our tour manager who was French, spoke English well, but he did have an accent, and he was a big guy.
Yeah,
he was probably 6'1" or 2", and somewhere in the, I'd say, 230 pounds plus.
Well, that's me today.
240 pounds plus, big guy.
And then I was talking to you.
Well, that's who I remember was handling things then.
Well, he was a very smooth-talking cat.
But like I said, it was a reforming time. So we didn't start up with a stable crew. We started up with a crew, and one by one they got replaced until we got the stable people we were looking for.
So you blow into my control room in Timmins, Q92 FM. And you guys are larger than life, and I just rolled Fast Train to kind of welcome you in. And I said, "Hey, Jerry, Fast Train, cool track." And you said, "Yeah, cool track, but I'm not on it because it came out before you joined the band." And so we chatted for a while, and what I remember from that encounter was you made me promise to play your new track right after you left so you could listen to it in the van on the way to the gig. And I did. Now, you had some favorite tracks.
What did I request?
I don't know, but it would have been one of the rockers off the album, I would think. I don't remember what the singles was.
The best one was
the
song
days.
Called Better Slow Down.
Yeah, I don't remember what the single
Better
was
Slow
off the album.
Down but was based on a guitar lick.
But we were playing it. We were. It was in heavy rotation. April Wine, of course, being CanCon, was in heavy, heavy rotation for us.
All the time. So
it was great seeing you then. And it was, as soon as I 30 odd years went by, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to reach out to Jerry because I think he would love to talk about this old stuff. I'm so glad I was able to catch up with you.
Well, it's good. We can, you know, there are so many stories, so many things we didn't even begin to touch on. I don't know at what level your readers will find this particular broadcast, but if it's popular, I'd gladly do some more. There are other stories. There's just so much over the years. I can't even sit here and tell you the stories, but if you and I are talking, you're going to ask me a question or say something, and it's going to remind me of something else, and away I'll go. And that's how the stories can unfold. It's not pre-planned. It's a jam.
It's a jam. I would really like that.
And that's the fun of it, you know? So you're recording all this stuff. It'll be from listening to a series of recordings like that, that sooner or later I'll put the book together, a book. It's only by listening to programs that I do that I can, you know, I don't think of this stuff on a daily basis. I only think of it when someone asks me.
For sure.
And I delve into it, but I've never sat down and said, I'm going to write a book. But I figure it'll happen if we do enough of these kind of recordings.
Right. Well, you know what? Our folks would love to hear the stories, and we would love to hook back up with you and just jam and just, you know, talk about the old days and just get those stories flowing.
I don't mind at all. In fact, if we did another one, perhaps by then I would be able to take my bass and actually demonstrate singing a couple of April Wine tunes.
That would be very cool.
That's a wrap on Talking Blues. If the blues speaks to you, hit subscribe, share the show, and let's keep the tradition alive. Until next time, keep it raw, keep it real.